Okay, let's get started. So today we're going to take a little break from drawing the little boxes, the preparation, transformation, and measurement boxes. And we're going to talk about composite systems and entanglement. So if I have two separate systems that I've prepared independently, and I can describe them with, if I can describe system A with Hilbert space A, that has the following basis, and system B with Hilbert space B with this basis, then I need to find some description that can accommodate all possible combinations of these basis states. So what I want is a Hilbert space that has the following basis. Okay, and it turns out that the appropriate structure for doing that is called the tensor product. So I want to describe system A, B, then the Hilbert space for that is going to be the tensor product of system A and system B. And we saw that yesterday in one of the tutorials when we were talking about physical ensembles of particles. There we had a collection of many different particles, and the density operator that described these particles was the tensor product of density operators on each of their individual Hilbert spaces. Okay, so what is the dimension of this Hilbert space? It's going to be the product of the dimension for Hilbert space A. And dimension of Hilbert space B, which is kind of interesting because if we compare it to a classical scenario, let's say you have some sort of state vector representing a classical the state of a classical particle. Maybe it's got three position components and three momentum components. Then that's six variables describing that particular particle. And then if we have two of those, then the state space for that is just going to be 6 plus 6. So you've only got 12 variables representing two systems. While here, it's the product of the dimensions. So you can see that for quantum states, the state space to describe your state kind of grows really quickly with the number of particles, while for classical states, doesn't grow that quickly. But things are a little bit different in the classical case if we consider probability distributions. So if I have, rather than a specific set of parameters describing that classical particle, if I now have a probability distribution over those, then if I want to consider two particles and consider the joint probability of these two particles, then the state space is going to grow as the product of the dimensions rather than the sum. So I think that's an interesting comparison between the classical case and the quantum case. Okay, so if we have this type of structure, we can write down the most general pure state. So an arbitrary vector in this joint Hilbert space can be written as a linear combination of kets on the independent Hilbert spaces. So I can say psi AB is equal to sum over AL, some coefficient that depends on K and L, and then the two basis states. Okay, and we'll see later that it's really useful to introduce something called the Schmidt decomposition, which is a way of rewriting this state in this form. So anytime I have a state like this, I can always rewrite it. So there always exists decomposition like this. Which is a nice decomposition because now I only have a sum over one variable rather than over two. But still, these states form an orthonormal basis. So I have this condition that phi I phi j, so the inner product of these is a delta function, and also for the other Hilbert space. So we'll see later that this actually makes calculations really nice, and we can express some interesting quantities in terms of these parameters, which are called the Schmidt coefficients. So maybe just to get some terminology down, this is known as the Schmidt decomposition. These things are the Schmidt coefficients. And then these things are the sometimes known as the Schmidt modes or Schmidt vectors. And the Schmidt coefficients, they satisfy the following condition. Maybe I'll write it up here. That they add to one, and they're all non-negative real numbers. Okay, so we can see that in general, this type of state, it cannot be written as a product of two different states on each of the Hilbert space. Each of the individual Hilbert spaces. So if we only had one term here, then it could be written as a product state. But anytime we have more than one term, we can't write it as a pure state on one Hilbert space and pure state in the other one. And so that's actually what we use to define entanglement for pure states. So I'll just give you the definition. And it's for both pure and mixed states, it's easier to define some, what isn't entangled and then just say anything that doesn't satisfy that condition is entangled. So for pure states, we say that the pure state psi AB of a composite system AB that can be expressed as this tensor product. Of states is called a separable state. And then we say otherwise it's called entangled. So given that definition, we can see that if we have a state written in its Schmidt decomposed form, if there is more than one Schmidt number that's non-zero, then we know that the state is entangled. We can also define an entangled state that is mixed, so the definition is in the same form. I'm not going to rewrite it again, but I will just tell you what the criteria is. So it's separable if it can take this form. Otherwise, it's entangled. So you can see that the definition for a separable mixed state is slightly different to the one for a separable pure state. So for the mixed state, of course, something that's just a product of two density operators is separable, but we also allow things, allow states that have classical correlations. So you can have some type of correlation between here and here. So it would still count as separable in the sense that it's not entangled, but it does have some type of correlation. So we'll talk a little more about correlations in a minute, but I guess I just want to point to a few things. So entanglement, it's a type of correlation that is stronger than a classical correlation, and I'll show you later what I mean by that. But if you have a pure state, the only correlation you can have is entanglement, while for mixed states, you can have quantum correlations, such as entanglement, but you can also have classical correlations. So they're kind of different in that way. Okay, so maybe let's have an example. And now I'm talking about pure states again. So state A, B. So we can see that this state is entangled because it satisfies this definition here. It cannot be written as a product of a state on system A, system B. So what are the practical consequences of having a state like that? So what I have is I have two systems. Maybe I can think about them as two different particles. So I have particle A and particle B. And now imagine I have two friends, Alice and Bob. And they're here with me. And I prepare this entangled state. And I give particle A to Alice. And I give particle B to Bob. And then Alice goes up to her room on the third floor. Bob goes up to his room on the fourth floor. And then Alice decides to make a measurement on her state. So she's going to measure in the 0, 1 basis. And she's going to get some sort of outcome. She won't know what it is, but once she gets an outcome, either 0 or 1, it's going to collapse the state into only one of those terms. So if she gets outcome 0, it'll collapse the state into that state. If she gets outcome 1, it'll collapse it to that one. And so then she knows that if Bob were to make a measurement on his particle in the 0, 1 basis, then she can guarantee what result he's going to get. If she got result 0, he's also going to get result 0. If she got result 1, he's always going to get result 1. And that's going to be true even if Alice and Bob went to, you know, opposite ends of the universe, as long as they were like really careful with making sure that the state was protected and didn't get destroyed. So you might be impressed by this, or you might be suspicious and thinking, well, that's not really like that cool, because I could imagine a classical scenario where I can do the same thing. So let's say if Alice and Bob came back here, and now they each had a box, an empty box. Okay, so we are talking about boxes, but they're different boxes this time. And now I go through this classical preparation procedure. So I have my coin, unbiased coin, and I flip the coin, and if I get heads, then I just prepare two particles in the zero state. And I put the zero particle in Alice's box, and I put the zero particle in Bob's box. Or if I got the, I flip my coin and I got tails, whatever the opposite one is, then I prepare particle one, two particles in the one state, and put my particle A in Alice's box and particle B in Bob's box. And then they go off to their rooms and go through the same procedure. So the density operator that would correspond to this state would be, that's a composite system, but with probability a half, I prepare the state zero for Alice and state zero for Bob. And with probability a half, I prepare the state one for Alice and the state one for Bob. And so now if Alice measures her particle in the 0-1 basis and she gets the outcome zero, I'm going to collapse this state to just this term here. And if she gets the measurement result one, I will collapse the state here. And then I can predict, I can guarantee that Bob is going to get the same result that Alice got. So it doesn't seem like there's anything special going on here. This state is clearly not entangled, given by that definition of a separable state, but it has these classical correlations. So what's so special about the entangled state that is different to the classically correlated state? That's a rhetorical question, but if you want to like chime in, you can say. Okay, so the thing that's special is that this state is correlated in not just the 0-1 basis, it's correlated in all of the possible bases. So I could rewrite the state psi AB maybe in the plus basis or plus minus basis. Sorry. Where the definitions of plus and minus are just the same ones we've been always using. So if I rewrite it, I see that it looks like that. And I can go through the same procedure, except now Alice measures in a different basis. She measures in the plus basis, a plus minus basis. So when she gets outcome plus, she knows Bob will get the same outcome plus. She gets outcome minus, she knows Bob will get outcome minus. And this holds for any possible basis, or any possible measurement on the Bloch sphere. In some of the bases, they're correlated, and some of them, they're anti-correlated, but you always know whether it's correlated or anti-correlated, and then you can predict what outcome the other party would get if they made a measurement. Well, if we did the same thing for the classically correlated state, I'm not going to rewrite this state in the plus-minus basis because it's really gross, it has a lot of terms. But I will show you what it looks like if Alice got one of the results. So if Alice measured in the plus minus basis and she got result plus, then the state would collapse to something like this. So of course, Alice's state will collapse to the plus state. But then if you go through the calculation, you'll find that Bob's state becomes the completely mixed state. And so then we can't say anything about what measurement Bob, what measurement result Bob would get if he were to measure in the plus minus spaces, because half the time he'd get this one, half the time he would get that one. So you can see that for the classically correlated state, even though it's correlated in one basis, it's not correlated in all of the bases. And so that's what we mean when we say that entanglement is a correlation that's stronger than classical correlation, because it's correlated over many different degrees of freedom. Okay, so so what would happen if, let's say, so let's say if maybe you're Alice, or maybe I prepare this entangled state and I just give you particle A. Maybe I have some repeatable procedure where I can prepare the state over and over again. But in any case, I'm never going to give you the full state. I'm only going to give you state A. What could you do to characterize that state? And so for the people who are jumping ahead, I don't mean the mathematical operation. I mean, like, operationally, physically, what would you do if I was just giving you a state that is a particle that is entangled with another particle, and you wanted to have some sort of description of that state? Does anyone have ideas?
They could trace in other particle spaces.
No, I don't mean mathematically. So I mean physically. Like, you, trace is not a physical operation. Like, okay, so before. Sorry?
You measure
it. Yeah, you can measure it many times. So you do the same thing that you always do, which is do quantum state tomography on your on many copies of the same state. So the thing we're imagining is I'm creating many of these entangled states, and I'm always just giving you particle A, so you can perform whatever measurements you like. Measure in the sigma z basis, sigma x basis, get the expectation values, and reconstruct a density matrix. And that, well, just to remind you, the density matrix that you would get would look like this. So you've got the expectation values of the Pauli operators times the Pauli operators. So if you only have access to part of the part of the entire system, your best description of that system is going to be a density operator that corresponds to the measurements that you can make just on that system. And as Fatih was alluding to, the mathematical operation that corresponds to doing this is called the partial trace. So if I've been given a like mathematical expression for the quantum state, I can compute what the density operator is by taking the partial trace. So in the language that we typically use is that if this is a density operator for the composite system, then this operator is called the reduced density operator. So a partial trace is just like a regular trace, except you only do it on part of the system. So let's define what we mean by that. Thank you. So before, when we just had a regular trace, the way that we would do that is to just sandwich the operator between all of the basis elements spanning that entire Hilbert space. So we're going to do that here, but we'll only do it over the basis states for system B. And I will do nothing on system A. So I'm just acting the identity on system A. And then same here, acting the identity on system A. And the basis state on system B. And then usually because we get lazy and don't want to draw identities all the time, we just drop the identity and simply write something like this. And it's understood that there's an implicit identity acting on the Hilbert space corresponding to system A. So we start off with something that is an operator on system Hilbert space A and B, and then after we act the partial trace, we end up with a reduced operator that only acts on Hilbert space corresponding to A. So let's just go through it explicitly for this general entangled state written in the Schmidt decomposition. So I would have rho A is equal to trace over B of the outer product of that Schmidt decomposed space. And then to do the trace explicitly, we want to pick a basis in order to do the trace. And so looking at that state, it seems like the best basis to choose is the basis corresponding to the Schmidt modes of that state. So we know that those form an orthonormal basis. So we'll write the trace as a sum over K. And now we know that the B bras are just going to act on the B kets, and we can make use of that orthonormality condition. So we just get a bunch of delta functions. And then we can use those delta functions to collapse the sum and just get sum over K.
Isn't our lambda J supposed to be lambda J complex conjugate?
It's a real number. Is that true? That might not be true.
Well, if we're signing them to one, then maybe they should be.
Yeah, I think that I think you can always pull the phase into the definition of the the state. Okay. So yeah, I think in general you can assume that they're real. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so what do we see? We see that if, so I said before that if there's more than one term in that entangled state, in that state up there, then the state is entangled. And here we can see that if there's more than one term, then the reduced density matrix is going to be a mixed state in general. Yep.
Sorry, is it lambda I squared?
Yeah, probably. Let me just confirm, but I think that's true. Okay, I have it written like that, but I think you're right. It is. Okay, sorry, it's not going to come down. So it's lambda squared. And let me make a note to update the notes. Okay, but as I was saying, that if we have more than one term, so if the state is entangled, then you can see that the reduced density matrix is going to be mixed in general. While if there's only one term, then we only have one term in the sum, and then this is just an outer product, which is going to be a pure state.
So if they're lambda squares, are they lambda squares all along then? So at the end we
No, just in the sum over. So yeah, everywhere they're lambdas except in that condition. And I guess the reason you noticed that is because you were wanting this state to be normalized, right? Yeah. Okay, and actually one thing I wanted to say, when you're taking the, maybe I'll write it up. When you're calculating the partial trace, it's really annoying to like write out everything and sandwich it between the basis states. So you can just use this kind of shorthand trick where if you have all of your states written out, like if you have your density matrix written out in terms of the individual components, you can always, okay, so if you're tracing out system B, then you would look at the components that are the outer products of, call it X. Running out of letters. Q, P. Okay, so you would have terms like this in your sum, and then the trick is to just do nothing to system A. And then just like turn the bras into the cats into bras and the bras into cats. And then you get a inner product between these two things. So that just saves you a step whenever you're doing the traces by partial traces by hand. So an example of that. Would be if I had J just a really simple density operator, maybe the one that we drew just before. Then to look at system A, which is traced out over B, I do nothing to system A, and then I just turn the cats into bras for system B. Do nothing to system A, and turn the cats into bras, and vice versa. And then you just evaluate the inner products. Sometimes they're going to be orthogonal, sometimes they won't be. And the thing that you're left with is a mixed state on system A. So you don't have to go through this whole step of actually picking a basis or anything, just like swap the bras and cats. Okay, so what did I show you? I just showed you that if the state is entangled, then, well, okay, if the state is separable, then my reduced density operator is going to be pure. If the state is mixed, if the state is separable, then the reduced density matrix is pure. If the state is entangled, then the reduced density matrix is mixed. And it turns out that if the state is something called maximally entangled, then the reduced density matrix is going to be maximally mixed, which means it'll be proportional to the identity. So there's this direct relationship between how entangled the composite system is and how mixed the reduced density matrix is. And so we can use that to actually quantify the amount of entanglement in this state. So, and the way that we do that is we make this connection between the mixedness in the reduced density matrix and the entropy of that density matrix. So the lower the entropy, the more pure the state is. And we can just calculate that. So if we look at so let's say characterizing entanglement. So I can compute the entropy of the reduced state. So let's say entropy for system A will be given by minus the trace of rho A log A. Which we find that we can just express in terms of these Schmidt coefficients. So I can write that as minus sum. Minus sum over k lambda k squared log of lambda k squared. So the thing I didn't show you here is that, so we can compute the reduced density matrix for system A, but similarly, the reduced density matrix for system B will be in terms of the Schmidt coefficients. So it'll have the same coefficients, but it'll have different basis states. So both of the subsystems are written in terms of the same Schmidt coefficients, which makes sense given the form of the Schmidt decomposition. And so then we find that the entropy of system A is going to be exactly the same as the entropy of system B. And so now if entropy of the subsystem is zero, then we know that the composite system was entangled. Is unentangled, sorry, separable. And then higher entropy means more entanglement. Okay, so I want to I want to give you a couple of explicit examples of this, of how you would compute the Schmidt decomposition for a given state, and then how we can infer the entropies, or how we can compute the entropies and then get information about how entangled the state is. So the first example was just going to be a simple example for a qubit. So let's look at. Is this state already written in the Schmidt decomposed state? Is this already a Schmidt decomposition of a state?
No.
Why is that?
Because they're not orthogonal, right?
Because they're not orthogonal, exactly. So the state of system A here is not orthogonal to the state of system B. So in practice, the way that we would compute this rewrite it. Well, you could stare at it and just figure it out for this simple example. But in general, what you would do is you identify. So for this state, you would identify what those CKLs are. So first, I would want to write this in some sort of orthonormal basis. So I would have 0.5 0 0 plus 0.5 0. 1 0 1 minus 1 1. Okay, by now you can probably just like do it in your head, but I'll just show you how you would do it for a more general case. So then you say that Cij, or C, the matrix, is 0.5 0.5 0.5 minus 0.5, which would be that matrix over there. And then you could just plug it into MATLAB or Mathematica using this command singular value decomposition. And then what you get out is a set of three matrices. So you get U, W, and the transpose of a matrix B. From this, you can read off the Schmidt coefficients and the Schmidt vectors. So the diagonal elements of the matrix in the middle are going to be your Schmidt coefficients. And then these rows correspond to the coefficients of the state vector in the basis that you started off with. So the state would then be 1 on root 2, 0. Oh, hang on a second. So Schmidt coefficient half, then 1 on root 2, 0, plus 1 on root 2, minus 1 on root 2, 1. So this one and this zero corresponds to those states. And then you can see, well, this is the familiar plus state and this is the familiar minus state. So I just get 1 on root 2 minus 1 plus 1 on root 2 plus 1. Oh, yeah, plus 0. Okay, and then, yeah, this is in its Schmidt decomposed form. So that's a really simple example, but hopefully that gives you intuition for what's going on. And then I want to show you a complicated example that's actually useful for something.
So yeah. So do you just a diagonalize C?
Yeah, but it's not the same. It's not just any diagonalization. So what's important here is that the basis elements that you get are orthonormal. So if you just did like a regular diagonalization, you don't necessarily get this condition that all of the basis states for system A are orthogonal to each other and all of the ones for system B are orthogonal to each other. And that becomes useful because then later when you're computing things like partial traces and stuff, you already have it written in an orthonormal basis.
Wait, so is that first state supposed to be minus
so
0b plus a when the first time you wrote it?
This one?
The first time you wrote it over there.
That one? Zero. It's supposed to be that.
But then we get 0b plus a.
Yeah, does it not?
No, it's the other one. Minus A, 1B, right?
You think there should be a plus here? And a... It should be whatever makes it work.
That one, the first one there, just minus A, 1B, which is the second one on the in the first expression.
Sorry, I'm
like... Can we just switch which one we write first? It's the same expression.
You think it should be 1 minus?
No, I think that's good, but like your first thing here is the second element there. That's the only difference. No, but the first element there is not the second.
No. I mean, so here, this is orthogonal to this. So this is the Schmidt decomposed form. Yeah.
I'm saying we have minus A1B here,
yeah.
And we also have minus A1B there.
Yeah.
And plus A0B. Oh, okay, that's the difference. Okay. Yeah, that's the problem. No, I think the first one is okay, but that one's different.
But I don't want it to look the same as that. I want it to be different. So the point is I started off with a state that is not in a Schmidt decomposed form. And I've rewritten it in a Schmidt decomposed form.
Okay.
They're mathematically equal to each other, but this is written in a way that the states in system A are orthogonal to each other and the states in system B are orthogonal to each other. While here it's not the case because zero is not orthogonal to the minus. Yeah.
Yes. I think the concern is mathematically like
systems. But they are.
Okay.
Are they not? Oh, okay, so hang on, where's the minus sign? So there should be a plus in front of every sign except for a minus in front of the 1-1 term. And here there's a minus in front of the 1-1 term. So I think they're the same. And everything else has a plus in front of it. So I would get 0-1 plus 0-1. That's that term. Minus 1-1 is this term. Plus 0-0 is that first term, and oh yeah, maybe there's something wrong there. No, hang on. Yeah. Okay, whatever. You can go through it yourself. I think it works, but you can go through it yourself and check. Okay, so that's a like contrived example, but I want to give you a real, actually useful example. The other ones. And this is to do with like my favorite thing in the world, which is parametric down conversion. So just to remind you, on Friday we were talking about this process, which was this nonlinear crystal that we shine a laser into, and then with some probability we get pairs of photons. And then I told you that the output state is some coherent superposition of zero photons plus one pair of photons plus two pairs of photons, and so on. And then we went through this really involved calculation where we actually looked at just this term and saw how the spectral distribution of those photons depended on the shape of the input pump laser and some material properties of the crystal. So this term here, which I'll just call psi 2, we saw that we could write it as this integral over the two frequencies of the photons, some type of joint spectral amplitude function, and then two creation operators with some spectral distribution. Okay, so it turns out that you can actually define the Schmidt decomposition for continuous functions as well. So you can always write f of omega a times f of omega b as some sum of separable functions, separable spectral functions just acting on the individual Hilbert space. And so then if I do that, I can rewrite the two photon state as sum over k, lambda k, and then these separable functions where okay, so I've rewritten the two photon state as a sum over separable states. And so now what I can do is I can write down the state of just this photon. So let's call this A and B. And I want to compute the reduced density matrix for one of the photons. And if I do that, I get this mixed state. Where each one of these states here corresponds to a single photon in some strange spectral distribution. So what this tells me is that if I had a spectral entanglement between these two photons coming out here, and I use this as a source of heralded single photons. So if I put a detector here and waited for that detector to go click and say I have a photon, then the photon that I'm creating here is going to be spectrally mixed, which is really bad for your experiment because states that are mixed don't interfere very well on an interferometer. So if you're we're going to try and like do some sort of interference experiment or some sort of like build a quantum computer out of these photons, it would just not work very well and fail a lot of the time. So it's really important to try and decorrelate these two photons in the frequency degree of freedom. And so I wanted to show you, oh, it's a shame that it's, I'm going to cover up the board, but I just wanted to show you how this is done in practice. So could we please get the, thank you, read my mind. So in practice, like even though this thing is a continuous function, in order to make progress, we discretize things. So what I've drawn here, this thing here, is a matrix representation of this function. So on the x-axis, we would have one of the frequencies. On the y-axis, we have the other frequency. And then the colors represent the magnitude of this function. And so this is an example of a realistic one that you would expect to get from some crystal that exists. And so what we then do is, so we've discretized it, it's a matrix, and then we can just do this singular value decomposition that I showed. And what we get out is a matrix with a lot of singular values, but you see then they eventually kind of go to zero. And then we get this other matrix with the Schmidt modes, which kind of looks gross and doesn't tell you very much. But what you can do is just like pull out. So in this case, I think every column corresponds to a specific Schmidt mode. So we can just pull out the first few columns and plot them as like functions of frequency. And so what I drew here, I guess you can't really see it, but each of the Schmidt modes in that sum corresponds to one of these spectral functions for each of the photons. So that might not tell you very much, but the thing you're most interested in is what the Schmidt coefficients look like. So I can plot the Schmidt coefficients, and we see that there's more than one. So this tells me that there's some spectral entanglement in that particular joint spectral amplitude. And I can use these Schmidt coefficients to calculate the purity of that state or calculate the entropy of entanglement of that state. And so then what I want to do is, if I'm designing a source of heralded single photons and I want the photons to be pure, I want to try and tweak my parameters in a way that improves the purity of this photon. So I can like just plot the purity here as a function of maybe like the pump width of the incoming laser, and I can say, well, for this particular pump width, I get the maximum purity and so on. So you can actually, like, things here, you can use them to, like, do real science. And so, yeah, now I can, like, tell some experimentalists, build your source with these parameters, and you'll get, like, a better single photon source. Okay. So, okay, can we get the screen up, please? Oh, yeah?
When you plotted those Schmidt modes,
yeah,
there was like a feature where it looked different. Like there was a
So I think that would be just numerical artifacts. By that stage, what's happening is that the Schmidt values are like numerically equivalent to zero, and then at the point when the Schmidt values become numerically equal to zero, I think it's just like plotting random Schmidt functions. But it doesn't matter because eventually you just multiply them by something that's numerically equal to zero. Yeah, that pretty much, I think what that told me was that I didn't need to go so far out. I could just consider the first few functions. Yeah. Okay, and I guess one other thing that I wanted to just briefly mention. So here I was talking about entangled states and entropy of reduced density matrices. So this has some connection with things that people study with black holes. So I said something earlier about entangled pairs of photons being created, or entangled pairs of particles being created at surfaces of event horizons. So there, if one of them is outside the event horizon, one is inside, then that state has some entropy and it's somehow connected to the black hole entropy, which is something that I don't do research in, so I won't be able to tell you much about that beyond pointing you in that direction. But if you want to know more about those things, you could talk to David or some other people. But that's just to say that people in other fields are also using these types of ideas. And then I guess the final thing is, so everything I, like the stuff that I deal with, it's I'm interested in frequencies because I'm making single photons. But you might be interested in, for example, having two different particles with some sort of joint spatial distribution, which would, you know, your two particle state would be described by something like this, but you'd have position operators here, operators, or distributions over position. So you might have some sort of entangled two particle state, and you're interested in characterizing that entanglement. You can use like exactly the same techniques that we discussed here for those systems as well. And what's nice is you can do a lot of the calculations analytically using these nice properties of the Schmidt decomposition, and then right at the end, get whatever quantities you're interested in terms of the Schmidt values, and then you can just plug some stuff into Mathematica and get out values. So it makes it easier to calculate things that would maybe be more difficult to calculate usually. Okay, so far everything I've been, like all of the examples I've been giving you have been for pure states. So if we have some sort of pure entangled state, we can look at the entropy of the reduced density matrix. But all of this just like gets thrown out the window once we start looking at entangled mixed states. So I just wanted to say a few things about that. Okay, so imagine I have this particular mixed state. So it's a state of two composite systems. Okay, this is now a mixed state. And it's not entangled because I can write it in that form. But you can see that if I were to calculate the reduced density matrix, so just look at system A, I would get something that looks like that. So this is now a mixed state, but it doesn't tell me anything about the entanglement here. So just looking at the mixture of the reduced density matrix is not enough information to tell you about the entanglement. On top of that, you have to have this additional information that your composite system was pure to begin with. As soon as it's mixed, then, you know, whatever, you can't tell anything just by looking at the reduced density matrix. So is there anything we can say about entanglement of mixed systems? Well, one thing we can do is, before I say that, okay. I want to remind you of these this thing we were talking about yesterday called the completely positive trace preserving map. So I'll just write down the definition again. So if rho AB which is defined like this is positive, let me write it and then I'll say it. So E is a completely positive map if rho AB is positive, if this initial state was positive. So I'll like explain now what I mean by that. So why are we interested in positivity at all? The reason we're interested in positivity is because we're trying to use these maps to describe realistic transformations on physical quantum systems. So we need our density operator to always be positive for it to describe a physical system, because this ensures that any measurement that we make is going to give us positive probabilities. So we want rho to always be positive. So if we want rho to always be positive, we need maps that take positive operators to positive operators. But a positive map is not sufficient, because if I have a state that's entangled, so let's say if I have a state like this, and I apply a positive map to just one of the systems, let's say system A, then sometimes I can get a negative density operator out. So I want to say a positive map can sometimes yield So if I have just a single system and I apply a positive map, I'll always get a positive density operator. But if I have an entangled system and I apply a positive map to just one of the systems, I might get a negative density operator out. So that's not physical. So we need this stronger condition, which is complete positivity, so that when we act the map on just one of the subsystems, we guarantee that we always get a positive operator out. So that's a type of map that we would use to describe physical systems, physical transformations. But the reason I'm talking about it now is that we can actually use this idea of a map being positive but not completely positive to check whether a state is entangled or not. So if I have if I now have some sort of map that's positive, if a map is positive, but not completely positive. Positive. Then it's not physical, but it's some kind of mathematical operation that I can apply. So I can just take this state, some density operator, and I can apply this map to it. And if I get, if the state that comes out has negative eigenvalues, then that gives me information about whether the initial state was entangled or not. So an example of that is, hang on, let me see if I can finish that sentence. If a map is positive but not completely positive, and it yields rho AB with negative eigenvalues, then rho AB was entangled.
positive just mean that all of the eigenvalues are positive?
Yes. Yeah. So positive is a positive operator is defined as. For all psi. Yep. Sorry. So an example of a mathematical map that is positive, but not completely positive, is something called the partial transpose. So that is defined as, so I can always write a bipartite state as the sum of the following terms. So then partial transpose of system B would be doing nothing to system A, but transposing system B. And then that would look like so in each individual term, we leave system A unchanged, but we swap the coefficients for system B. So if we apply this operator to some given mixed density matrix of system A and B, and we get negative eigenvalues, then we can guarantee that that state was entangled. If you apply this map and get positive eigenvalues, then there's a certain special class of systems that this guarantees that it wasn't entangled. But in general, it doesn't really tell you anything. So if partial transpose gives output with positive eigenvalues, then the input was separable in the case of systems with 2x2 dimensions or systems with 2x3 dimensions. So only in those special cases does a positive output guarantee that the state was separable. So for all systems, all bipartite systems, if you get negative eigenvalues, that tells you that you had an entangled state, but only in some cases does positive eigenvalues tell you that you had a separable state. So it turns out that it becomes like really, really, really hard to say anything about entanglement for any systems that are more complicated than the things we've been dealing with. As soon as you get more dimensions, things get complicated. As soon as you get mixed states, things get complicated. As soon as you have more than two parties, things get complicated. There's this thing called monogamy of entanglement that says that if two parties are maximally entangled, then they cannot share entanglement with a third party. But then once you get less than maximal entanglement, things can, parties can share entanglement. So this stuff is like not, there's a lot of active research going on, but it's still not very well understood. But in the notes, I've linked to a paper that has a review article on all of these different ways of characterizing entanglement in more complicated systems. So then, final thing that I wanted to say is just show you how you would generate entanglement if you had a state that wasn't entangled. And we do that by applying entangling unitary operations. So consider this unitary operation, which is acting on both systems A and B, and it does the following. If system A is prepared in the zero state, it does nothing. And if system A is prepared in the one state, it applies a sigma x operation. So a sigma x takes 0 to 1 and 1 to 0, which is in like computer science, that's called a not operation. So here, this type of entangling gate is called a controlled not operation, because it either does nothing to system B or it applies a not, depending on whether the system A is in a particular state or not. Okay, so I have this definition for an entangling operation. And now imagine that I have an initial state of system A and B that is prepared in a separable state. So I prepare system A in the plus state and system B in the zero state. And now I want to apply this entangling operation. So the easiest way to do this is to decompose it all in the 0-1 basis. So I've just expanded the state plus in the 0-1 basis and then factored out the terms or expanded the terms. And now if you go through and actually apply that operation, you would find that what it does is it does nothing to this component, system B. But then if system A is in the state 1, it's going to flip this component. So then what we get out is an entangled state. So there I just wrote down some unitary, I kind of like pulled it out of nowhere, but we can actually build entangling operations like that using physics. So I won't show you exactly how to do this control NOT gate, but I'll show you how to do a slightly different entangling gate or entangling operation. And it turns out that all of the maximally entangling operations are equivalent to each other by local operations. So you can always turn one of them into the other one. Let's consider this physical system. I'm going to come back to an example that we saw in the tutorial last week. So we had two-level systems. And we had Hamiltonian describing these systems. And they were coupled by this sigma x coupling. So here, sigma z is just the sigma z Pauli operator and the sigma x Pauli operator. And then if you did the tutorial, you would have shown that you could go into the interaction picture and apply the rotating wave approximation, and then you would get some sort of interaction that looked like g sigma plus maybe I'll just write it out explicitly. It'll look like this, where I have assumed that I'm setting omega 1 equal to omega 2. So now we have this interaction Hamiltonian between these two-level systems. And to see how the output state looks, I would just apply the unitary evolution corresponding to that Hamiltonian on some initial state. So I can say that the unitary on both systems as a function of time is e to the I on h bar times the interaction Hamiltonian times time, which will be e to the minus I on h bar gt like that. And now if I apply this to an initial state where particle A is prepared in the excited state and particle B is prepared in the ground state, and I evolve them as a function of time, you get out cosine of GT on H bar times EG plus I sine GT on H bar. Okay. And so I can just apply this unitary evolution for some fixed amount of time. And if I pick T to be H bar pi on 4G, then the output state is and so we have our entangled state. So this is it's a slightly different entangled state to the one that we saw before, but it's essentially the same. Like, we could just now take this state and apply some phase operation to get rid of this I, and we could then flip the second bit, turn that into an excited state and that into a ground state, and we would get the same state that we had over there. Yeah.
Can you write this interaction Hamiltonian? Is there one copy of each time for each AMB for each system?
Yeah, what did I do? Yeah, I think I did something wrong. I think it should be, yeah, sorry. I transcribed it bad in my notes. Yeah, okay, so that's like totally wrong. Should be something like that. I'm pretty sure that follows though, but we can check it again. But this is similar to what we got when we did the spontaneous emission example, where we had the two-level atom coupled to the field, but now it's just coupling between two atoms rather than coupling to the EM field. Okay, so what have we looked at? We looked at pure state entanglement, and we saw that entanglement is a correlation that's stronger than classical correlation because it lets us have correlations between different bases of the state, not just correlations in one basis like you would get classically. We saw that we can quantify pure state entanglement by looking at how mixed the reduced density matrix is, and that we can also quantify mixed state entanglement by doing this partial transpose. And I showed you also a few, well, some of my research where we look at entanglement between the frequency components of the two photons. So in general, why would you be interested in studying entanglement? There's a few things. I mean, one of them is that it's just like it's there and it's different to what we see classically, but it's something, you know, we can observe that it exists, but we don't really understand it yet. So it's just worth studying it to understand it more. It's also interesting because it allows you to do certain things that you wouldn't be able to do without it. So one example of that is quantum teleportation. So that's something we will see on Friday, which is a protocol that allows you to send quantum information between distant parties without sending any quantum states. You only have to send classical information. It's also interesting because it's intimately connected with something called decoherence. So you can see that from this idea that if you have entangled states, the reduced density matrix is mixed. So maybe you can think about one reason why we don't see macroscopic coherent superpositions in the everyday world is because all of the big things are entangled with other big things, and then that entanglement, when you just look at the, you know, reduced state of, like, I don't know, this cup, all of the things that would give you coherent superpositions are kind of washed away because of the interactions of that cup with, you know, all of the molecules flying around and stuff. So it's interesting from that perspective. And it's also interesting because decoherence can make bad things happen, like it can make your quantum computer not work. So you really want to be able to understand, you know, like if you have some sort of quantum computer and it's not completely isolated from the environment, then it'll become entangled with the environment and you'll get decoherence inside your quantum computer and it's not going to function properly. So we need to understand how that entanglement works so that we can understand how to isolate our, let's say, quantum computer from the rest of the environment. So yeah, there's lots of things that are interesting about it and lots of things that are not understood. And tomorrow we will see how entanglement actually relates to the postulates that we've been talking about. So we will look at, we've already seen how reduced density matrices arise from entanglement in higher dimensions, but we will see how these CPTP maps arise from entangling operations on composite systems, and we'll see how generalized measurements arise from entangling measurements on composite systems. Any questions? Okay, so see you tomorrow.